Hey everyone, I'm Tyler.
And I'm Alicia.
And we are Medium Dives, where we want to talk about things, but we're too lazy to do a deep dive, so here we are.
Okay, first, I wanted to announce to all of our millions of listeners
loyal listeners.
We're going to change the way we're citing sources. Instead of trying to like say everyone's name and every title of everything constantly, we are going to list all the articles or websites that we use in the show notes instead of naming them all. Although, full disclosure, I might still mention some if I use like a ton of direct quotes from them.
100%, yes.
Like, especially journalists who, like, are more artsy in their way of writing. Do you know what I mean? Like, journalists who are, like, journalists. I feel a little bit bad just, like, ripping shit for them and not saying their name.
Oh, see? So, no remorse over on my end. So sorry. I love you all, journalists.
Good for you.
Thank you.
I also wanted to share. Well, first of all, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you? I'm well, it's been a day. How are you?
You've had a rough weekend. Well, this past weekend, Ethan and I listened to episode 3 together. He was listening with me while I was doing like a final screen. And he had a lot of questions about the cicada stuff. And so we did some Googling. And I have some follow-up information.
Please.
Because some of this, well, I probably would have let it go. I probably would have just gone on with my life. I mean, I didn't question it when you told me. Okay.
Thank you. That's exactly what I want.
Perfectly satisfied at the end.
Yeah. No one will ever question me ever.
Okay. So one, you were really upset that you're like, how the hell do all of them reach full growth at the same time? So, and now full disclosure, some of this information definitely came from comments on Reddit. So like, I don't know if they're correct.
And you know what? Reddit comments always tell the truth. I'm convinced.
I will say there frequently is a lot of good information there. And sometimes you just need an answer. And this is one of those cases. Like, I just need an answer, okay?
I don't care if it's right or wrong.
No, this does not impact me. But full disclosure, in case I'm spreading misinformation, these are Reddit comments. But so apparently, there's like pressure to be ready to emerge at the same time, because that's when they reproduce. So they eventually evolve to mature around the same time, or else they're going to miss out on mating season. And more importantly, there are variations in growth time. But the stragglers get weeded out because they aren't reproducing.
Evolution?
Yeah, because like they come out and there's like not that many cicadas. So they're like, "Mom." But there have been instances where enough stragglers are straggling that they create a new brood.
Us. That would be us.
Yes.
If we were cicadas.
So I thought that that might give you some answers. And then
thank you. I appreciate
it. Ethan's biggest qualm with that episode was, okay, so they're living underground the entire time. Why don't we see them every time we like dig a little bit in the ground? Like, what's going on there? Like, where are they? And so apparently, since they eat the tree root sap and stuff, they only hang out near the strong root systems. So you would see them probably if you dug like right next to a really big tree or something like that. Or if there's like construction that clears out like a bunch of shrubbery and trees, then you might see a lot of them. But that's why, like, in your garden, you might not see them.
That makes a lot of sense. I also wonder how big, because it's the nymphs that go underground, so I wonder how big a nymph is.
I looked it up because I was like, well, if it's, like, one millimeter, I feel like I do see bugs like that when I dig in the ground. They're, like, an inch long. Like, they're...
Oh.
Yeah, they're big boys.
Hefty, hefty.
Anyway, in case anyone was being kept awake with those questions. There you go.
Ethan, thank you. We love you.
Oh, he also recommended that we do an overview of our topics. Like, I share what topic I'm doing, and then you say what you're going to do, and then we go into it as an intro.
Oh, cool. I like
if you
it.
Like
to
that.
Give a little primer. Yeah, that sounds wonderful. Oh, okay. Ethan.
I know. He's got such good ideas. Okay.
Bless him.
So I, this week, am covering non-water floods.
I'm so excited.
What are you doing?
I am doing the Kowloon Walled City. which is the most densely populated city on Earth ever that is no longer here.
Interesting.
I know, right? I'm excited. I'm really excited.
I do like this. It's like a little sneak peek.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll just jump into it. I'm doing these in chronological order. Oh. Which also, blessedly, happens to have the more tragic ones in the beginning, so that at the end, we can just laugh at how silly it is.
Forget. Control-Alt-Delete. Remove from memory.
But I want to... one of them in particular is, like, a massive tragedy. But
yeah.
It's still very interesting, but these other ones we can kind of laugh about. Cool. Okay. So, it was a Friday on June 18th. In 1875, and at around 8 p.m., the fire alarm was raised at a whiskey distillery in Dublin, Ireland.
Oh.
Experts aren't sure how the fire started, but I know that had a transition out of that voice. but they kind of acknowledged that there is an inherent risk when distilling whiskey, because the whiskey that's kept in casks is undiluted, high proof, and highly combustible. So.
Gotcha.
The wooden casks burst open, sending a, quote, burning river of whiskey flowing through the streets.
Oh, my God.
And this flow, this flow measured 2 feet wide, 6 inches deep, and stretched more than 5 blocks, which is about a quarter of a mile. And it's reported that people used hats, pots, cups, and any vessel they could find, including their own shoes, to scoop burning whiskey up from the streets.
Listen, mama's got to get her fix in, okay? You got to do whatever you got to do.
Now, James Ingram was the founder and captain of the Dublin Fire Brigade, and apparently he was very skilled at finding unconventional fire control methods. Wow. So at first they tried water, of course, but it wasn't putting out the fire because it was just carrying the burning whiskey to more homes and buildings. I guess like the burning whiskey like stayed on top. Which I don't truly understand the physics of, but I'm imagining like those cocktails that they light on fire.
Fair. Yeah.
I don't know.
Is alcohol less dense than water? I think it is, right?
It must be for that to happen. It has to be, right? Right?
Yeah.
I mean.
Interesting. Okay.
My limited understanding of physics. It sounds right. We'll go with that. Okay. So he tried that and he's like, well, I don't want to have other buildings catch on fire. So then he tried to create dams of gravel and dirt to stop the flood, but the whiskey just soaked through it and kept going.
Couple of questions. Yeah. How much, like, after a while, wouldn't the whiskey pour out and then we just have, how much whiskey was there? Like, how much time? Because, like, so, I'm getting the impression that this man has days to react, and I would think just a barrel leaks.
This was all, like, happening at that evening, like in the night with like a crew.
He was on his toes.
He had a crew. He wasn't like working alone. But apparently there were like 5,000 barrels of whiskey and most of them exploded.
That's a lot.
Now, I don't know how much whiskey is in a barrel, but 5,000 is a lot. So
that's a big number.
Yeah.
My very scientific analysis. Yeah.
Super big.
It's bigger than one.
Truly. Okay. So yeah, the gravel and dirt didn't stop it. So then he had the idea to use horse manure, because apparently the city had plenty of manure yards due to the era of horse-drawn transportation. So he and his crew built dams and coated the streets in manure, and it worked. It soaked up the whiskey and extinguished the fire. And with the burning river under control, they were able to focus their efforts on putting out the building fires.
Oh, gosh.
Now, there were some deaths, unfortunately, but it actually wasn't due to the fire itself. I'm just going to read this quote because it summarizes it best. Onlookers didn't realize the toxic strength of the undiluted alcohol, and the 13 people who died in the Great Whiskey Fire all perished from alcohol poisoning. Hundreds more were treated for poisoning in local hospitals, with several going blind and suffering brain damage. Yikes.
Oh my.
Yeah. They were like really excited about the whiskey, didn't realize it was like raw whiskey.
Whiskey. What time, like when was this?
This was in 1875.
Oh, okay.
Gotcha. This one is an old one.
Gotcha.
Out of the 5,000 barrels of whiskey, only 61 were recovered. And apparently a few went missing under suspicious circumstances, which I'm not sure exactly what they meant by that, but it was implied that six intoxicated men had tried to steal a few barrels and were later arrested.
They said, that river on fire of alcohol, I'm going towards it. I want the center, the source.
Yes. Some good came out of this, though. Distillers ended up creating more safeguards so that Amazing. This wouldn't happen. They helped legitimize the Dublin Fire Brigade. And they even formed their own fire departments. So.
Amazing.
Yeah, really building some community. Infrastructure there. Yeah, community. Okay, now this one truly is a tragedy, but it's also just like a shocking occurrence. Like, I can't believe this happened.
Gotcha.
So this one is the Great Molasses Flood. First, what exactly is molasses? I wasn't actually going to describe it, but one of these fancy journalists, Edwards Park, from a Smithsonian article in like the 80s, had a nice little description. So
let's hear it.
Here it is. Molasses is the main byproduct of the manufacture of sugar from sugarcane. It results from the continued boiling of cane juice, reminiscent of the boiling off of maple sap to produce maple syrup. When enough reboiling has gone on to wrench every bit of sugar out of the molasses, the resulting viscous liquid is blackstrap, the extra thick molasses used as an additive in cattle feed. It provides valuable carbohydrates in the diet of a cow.
Huh. Fascinating. I did not know that.
So that's molasses for you.
There you go. All right. That's it. That's our topic.
So around lunchtime on Wednesday, January 15th, 1919, a giant tank of molasses burst open in Boston. Now, this tank held enough molasses to fill 3.5 Olympic-sized swimming pools.
Oh, my God.
The tank was 50 feet tall and had a 90-foot diameter. More than 2 million gallons of molasses poured out, and it reached speeds of up to 35 miles an hour.
Molasses.
Well, because...
Slow as molasses.
Well, funny you say that, my next bullet point. Molasses is 1.5 times denser than water, and it is known for being slow to pour. Like you just said, slow as molasses.
God.
But it's a non-Newtonian fluid, and in the flood, quote, would have moved as a gravity current, much like a mudslide, avalanche, or lava flow.
Oh, my Lord.
This is another great description of sort of the moment it happened by that journalist, Edwards Park. At about 12:30, with a sound described as a sort of muffled roar, the giant molasses tank came apart. It seemed to rise and then split, the rivets popping in a way that reminded many ex-soldiers of machine gun fire. And then a wet, brown hell broke loose, flooding downtown Boston. Spill a jar of kitchen molasses, then imagine an estimated 14,000 tons of the thick, sticky fluid running wild. It left the ruptured tank in a choking brown wave, 15 feet high, wiping out everything that stood in its way.
Oh, no.
Now, the molasses caused a lot of wreckage in the city. It crushed buildings and infrastructure and trapped people and horses. And the mild weather that day in Boston, they think, allowed the molasses to flow better. So it flowed for about 2 blocks, and it was at a depth of like 1 to 3 feet. Reports were ranging. But as the temperatures dropped at night, the liquid became more thick and sticky, which led to people getting trapped in it. And rescue crews were quickly dispatched, but they had a hard time wading through it because it's sticky. It's molasses. And so, sadly, ultimately 21 people died and 150 more people were injured as a result.
Jesus Lord.
And it took days to find some of the deceased individuals.
Awful.
I know. This one is the tragic one, for sure.
Yeah, horrendous.
Now, in the immediate aftermath of the spill, there were some speculations about the cause of it. One was that there was an explosion from inside the tank due to the fermentation of the molasses. Hmm. Some speculated that anarchists had set off a bomb, which apparently... Your face right now.
Motherfuckers.
Apparently that had, like, happened recently or something. I don't know.
The hit against big molasses.
I didn't look into it. That's for a deep dive podcast.
Exactly. That's our motto.
It really is. The third explanation, which ended up being the correct one, was that there was a structural failure of the 4-year-old tank. And there were a ton of lawsuits afterwards.
Good.
And that litigation took about 6 years and involved about 3,000 witnesses.
Oh, wow.
The court ultimately found that the tank had ruptured and that there was negligence regarding the safety of the tank. So the company who owned the tank, they were called U.S. Industrial Alcohol. They were found to be liable and paid off between $500,000 and $1 million in settlements. Now, I'm not sure. I could figure out if that was 1919 money or 1983 money, which was when the article was written that I got that number from.
Interesting.
So today, if that was 1919 money, today that would be $9.3 million to $18.7 million.
That's it, though?
If it was 1983 money, then it's $1.5 to $3.2 million.
Dang.
And then survivors of those who were killed in the tragedy reportedly got about $7,000 per victim, which was either, in today's money, either $131,000 or $22,000, depending on when it originated. Somewhere in there.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow.
So there were a lot of problems with the tank. The steel walls were too thin to support the weight of a full tank of molasses.
Mm-hmm.
There was too much stress on the rivet holes. And in fact, that is where the cracks first formed.
Mm.
One engineer said that structural engineers knew better at the time, but that the tank was built quickly in 1915 to meet the rising demand for industrial alcohol, because at the time that was being used to make explosives in World War I.
But then it became a molasses tank?
I guess molasses was used to create industrial alcohol.
Oh.
I forgot to look up what kind of alcohol you can make with molasses.
I'd assume like rye?
Look up fermented, yeah, alcohol from molasses. What is that?
Rum.
Rum. Interesting.
Rum.
I would have never known. Well, there it is.
Cool.
Also, just to point out their freaking negligence, the U.S. Industrial Alcohol Company, they ignored groaning noises every time it was filled, and they ignored cracks in the tank. And they knew there were cracks in the tank because children used to bring cups to fill with the sweet molasses that dripped out of it. So they just ignored that shit.
The audacity.
I know. I know. Anyway, so that was a massive tragedy in Boston. And apparently, the smell of molasses lingered for decades. And it became like a very distinctive thing about Boston that it smelled like molasses there.
Interesting. Huh.
I don't know if it still does, but for a while, in 1983, it still did when the guy wrote that article.
I wonder if anyone did a study on like ecology changes or environmental changes. Post-molasses.
That'd be interesting. It probably really messed up the river.
That's what I'm saying, ocean. Right? Some
harbor.
It's over there.
Oh, they had a harbor.
Ah, tea.
Yes!
I know something.
Woo! Oh my God. That's so funny.
All right. God, it hurts being this stupid. Okay.
Listen, at least you're not me from last episode. Be like, is data and data different?
That was fantastic. That was fantastic.
Okay. So yes, that one is super sad, but just like a wild thing that happened. Now we can move on to a couple. I have two more. And in these ones, I didn't find any reports of deaths. So we can just have fun with these.
Fantastic.
Yes. We love that. Okay. The Rockwood Chocolate Factory Fire. So Rockwood and Company was one of the major chocolate players in the U.S. at the time.
What time period is this?
So the fire happened in 1919.
Gotcha.
But so they were one of the major chocolate players in the U.S. at the time. And I'm not sure where they ranked at the time of the incident, but apparently they were second only to Hershey's by the 1950s.
Wow.
Shortly after which they started to falter and then they closed in 1957.
Mm.
But I'm going to take you back to Monday, May 12th. 1919.
Let's do it.
At approximately 1 a.m. Now, I do want to point out that the molasses situation happened also in 1919 in January. A lot of things going on in 1919.
What's going on here, guys? What's going on?
But so this took place May 12th at approximately 1 a.m. A fire broke out in the Rockwood Shipping Department in Brooklyn, New York. Now, most of this information, all of this information, I got from articles that were written at the time. So, one, it's suspected that the fire was caused by spontaneous combustion, which isn't that a myth?
No.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
I don't think so.
I think it's a myth about humans being able to spontaneously combust.
I've heard that before.
I've heard that all of those cases are really just like people fell asleep with a cigarette or something.
Yeah. It's clear that the theory of spontaneous human combustion is snuffed out. Okay, and that is from the most reliable source in the world, the British Wikipedia, aka Britannica.
Amazing. We love them. Okay. So, never mind. Spontaneous combustion is real.
You heard it here first.
That is what they suspected the fire was caused by. And it burned for approximately 3 hours. But another article said that the firemen were still working on it at noon. And remember, it started around 1 a.m. So I'm not really sure what that means. The firefighters were able to put out the fire before it spread to other buildings, which is great. Only the one building was destroyed. But the chocolate and butter made it slippery. And apparently it kept the firemen slipping about.
Oh my God. The money I would pay to watch that in action. Granted, if no one was hurt, but just to be a fly on the wall.
Dude, wait for the next one. It is so silly.
I'm so excited.
The issue quickly switched to the fact that the water from firefighting washed a bunch of chocolate into the streets and, quote, it flowed through the street like molten lava with a foamy cap of white formed by the sugar and butter that rose.
Oh, see, I thought you were going to say poop.
That sugar and butter formed in crusts around the sewers at the end of the street, and it caused blockages, so that, like, increased the flooding of the chocolate.
Oh, my Lord.
One individual from the street cleaning department said that the flood was becoming so menacing that it was deep enough to float a rowboat for 2 blocks. It's just crazy to think about.
Real life Willy Wonka.
Yes.
You would catch me out there with, like, orange spray paint on my face with the whole Oompa Loompa hair just chugging along.
So apparently a bunch of children came, like, rushing to the fire so they could eat the chocolate from the street. And this this is at the start of one of the articles from the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. And it did not seem that it was, like, a quote from a kid or that anyone was there to witness it. I think that they were just, like, role-playing. Like, oh my God, this is probably what the kids were saying. So I just wanted to read you this quote because it's funny.
Cool.
Hey, fellers. I know where there's a fine fire. Instead of water coming out, good hot chocolate fudge is running all over the streets. You can lick it up. The cops are there, but they don't mind. They just grin. Come along.
I have to be going now.
Anyway, so I just thought that was silly. That's what they put in the beginning of the article. Apparently, an hour later, the truant department was called and hauled the children off to school.
The kids are kicking and screaming, give me my damn chocolate.
So I imagine this had to have been at least, like, after 8 a.m. So again, the 3 hour firefighting situation. You know what? Maybe the fire was out in 3 hours, but then they were dealing with the flood the rest of the time.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so anyway, that's it for that one. Okay, my last one. The Wisconsin Butter Flood. Just a shout out real quick to an article by John Onken in the Wisconsin State Farmer, because I used a lot of his stuff. So this took place in Madison, Wisconsin, at Madison Central Storage and Warehouse Company, after a fire broke out at around 3:30 p.m. on Friday, May 3rd, 1991. At the time, the government had a farmer milk payment program in effect. So farmers were paid a fixed price and their milk was processed into butter, cheese, and other dairy products. And then the government had a huge surplus of all of that butter and cheese and dairy stuff. And this warehouse was one of many across the country used for surplus storage.
Sorry to cut you off, but did you know that they stored a lot of that cheese in caves present day? Like, there is... I'm sure I'm butchering it, but, like, millions of tons of cheese in underground caves because of that.
That is crazy.
Because the government subsidized this excess. That's why also one reason why we have so many cow farms is because they thought that, like, everyone would drink milk and eat cheese and blah, blah, blah. But then it's cut down over time. But that subsidized. Yeah. It's crazy. Wild. It's crazy.
Yeah. Essentially, it turns out that, like, because the farmers were getting paid from the government, they're like, okay, let's create more. And then
I'm going to milk this goddamn cow. Yeah.
And then there was just, like, a fuck ton of butter and cheese. Like, I did not know that, though, about the caves. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's wild.
Topic for another day, man.
That's what I'm thinking. That's literally where my mind went.
Do it. Okay, so at the time of the fire, this warehouse stored 10 to 15 million pounds of government surplus butter. The warehouse also stored Ocean Spray cranberries.
Oh, and, I didn't think that's where you were going.
And 4 million pounds of Oscar Mayer sausages, or as one employee put it, millions and millions of hot dogs.
Oh, I thought you were going to say wieners. Damn it.
No, that would have been better. Now, there I could not find any reported deaths in this incident.
Fantastic.
But there were 4 minor injuries reported, but everyone was okay. There weren't even that many details about it. I think they were, like, pretty minor.
They got a paper cut by butter.
Well, they probably, like, fell or something.
Yeah, I guess. All right, fine.
I don't know. But I think, like, one of them was from a employee who worked there at the time the fire broke out. And then the others were firefighters who got injured, like, in this whole process. So, like,
makes sense. Gotcha.
Hopefully none of them are, like, dealing with long-term consequences with it. But no one died. So, again, we can have
fun. We'll take it.
Also, a nearby highway had to be closed, and the damage was estimated at 50 to 100 million. Now, if that is 50 to 100 million of 1991 money, then today that is 113.7, I'll just round, 110 to 230 million today in damages.
Oh, my.
Again, some of these, it wasn't clear if they were talking about, like, the money at the time. So, who knows?
Do you know, was the butter in liquid form to begin with?
I do not believe so. The fire melted the butter.
Ah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That'll do it. Yep. Fire hot. Butter melt. Yeah.
And butter is pretty easy to melt. It was later said that this was Madison's biggest fire ever. An investigation found out that it started due to a forklift battery malfunction. And it took more than a week to extinguish it completely because of burning insulation and the 20 million pounds of butter, cheese, and meat that made it difficult to deal with, especially since the butter fueled the flames, creating essentially a grease fire.
Yeah.
One report said that it took 20 hours to contain the fire and then another 8 days until it was officially put out, whatever that means.
Okay.
I'm wondering if that's 20 hours to get the flames out and then the rest of the time to deal with, like, smoldering.
Yeah, interesting.
I don't know. Didn't look into it.
And we won't, damn it.
This is Medium Dives. Thank you very much.
I know.
After 5 hours, the outside walls of the building collapsed and let loose a wave of melted butter that engulfed everything nearby. Now, this threatened the facility's anhydrous ammonia tanks. So they evacuated 3,000 residents that were in a half-mile radius, and they were all, like, sent to go chill at a high school for a bit. These are some descriptions of the scene and the experience by Stephen Davis. He was the chief of the Madison Fire Department at the time. He said, quote, "It literally was a river of butter."
Thanks, chief. Yeah.
The trucks, ladders, and other firefighting equipment were all in the middle of the sweet cream pond.
Oh, my God.
And there was at least 5 feet of butter collected in, like, the lower areas, downhill, I guess. And the more water firefighters used, the more gooey stuff flowed out of the building. This is my absolute favorite bullet point for my entire thing today. At one point, he stepped off a loading dock onto what he thought was solid ground and instantly found himself up to his chest in melted butter.
Oh. You get it, chief.
Oh my God. He said that a fatty dairy moat trapped the ladder trucks. So the ladder trucks couldn't get out and the fuel trucks couldn't get in. And so mechanics had to carry diesel fuel in buckets through the butter river so that they could keep the ladder trucks running and, like, fight the fire. It's just a mess.
I can't imagine being in the thick of that and then just having, like, an out-of-body experience for a second being like, this is fucking butter. This is butter.
This is, yeah. I'm in 5 feet of butter. Yeah. Jesus Christ. Yeah. Also, listen, the 5 feet, the areas where it was 5 feet, I'm sorry. I'm only 5'3".
You're dead.
That shit would be over my mouth.
Yeah, you are suffocating.
So scary. Okay. While the firefighters were doing their thing, the Department of Natural Resources was making multiple dams to protect Starkweather Creek, trying to steer the melted butter into a storm water discharge. And apparently water had to be pumped out of Pond 1 into another pond, Pond 2. Across the railroad tracks, because the butter was flowing in faster than it could be sent into the sanitary sewer.
Wow.
So that was, let's see, this started on May 3rd. By May 4th, more than 3 million gallons of melted butter and fire runoff had been pumped into the sanitary sewer. I can't even comprehend how much that is.
No, a lot.
And then it, yes, a fuck ton. It rained on May 5th. So the day after that, it started raining. And the Department of Natural Resources had to quickly build another two dams before noon to keep the butter from flooding over their last dam into the creek.
Oh, my.
Then, by the next day, another 11 million gallons had been pumped into the sanitary sewer. And there was a bunch of congealed butter in the two discharge ponds.
Dude, I hate when I'm, like, using butter and a little bit gets on my hand and I don't, like, I can't wipe it off. I cannot even begin to imagine.
I know. It's gotta be awful. The U.S. Department of Agriculture brought in salvage contractors to remove the food waste. And in the few weeks that followed, the cleanup consisted of hauling huge piles of meat to the landfill, trying to stay ahead of the rain and the heat that remelted the congealed butter, and slowly pumping butter out of the two discharge ponds. 2 weeks after the fire had started, the Department of Natural Resources said that their efforts were a success. And apparently, very few fish died after the fire. So, yay.
I find that really hard to believe. Interesting.
Yeah, they were successful, man, at keeping the butter out of the water. They did it.
The work. The work team.
Good for them. This is some more from Stephen Davis. As a reminder, he was the fire department chief in Madison. Apparently, the Madison Fire Department had to throw away almost all of the gear that was used because it was, like, all greasy and ruined.
Yeah.
He reported having butter in places a guy shouldn't have butter by the end of that night. He described the smell as a mixture of movie theater popcorn, baked ham, and burning cranberries, which all in all ended up being a rotten smell that lasted for years, like at their nearby fire station. Gross. And he has had to reassess his relationship with butter. Quote, it was...
he used to go to therapy for butter.
He said, it was between that and all the hams that we saw floating in the river of butter. I didn't eat ham for a little while after that. To close it out, according to the Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources records, the fire resulted in the release of 1,000 pounds of anhydrous ammonia, 5,000 tons of food products, including hams, hot dogs, bakery items, and cranberries, and 12,500 tons of dairy products, mostly butter and cheese.
Oh, my Lord.
Wild.
Awful. I know nothing of Wisconsin, but that makes sense that it happened in Wisconsin.
Butter and cheese is kind of their thing. Well, cheese in particular.
Right?
Yeah. But yeah, there it is. That's all I got for you today.
Good work. That was fantastic.
Now tell me about this also, forgotten city.
I'm probably going to have to pee in like 20 to 30 minutes. Just letting you know. So I'm going to have to pause.
Okay. Do you want to ever get like now?
No, because then like I'm not going to be able to.
It's not the right time.
I also have stage fright. Once I was at a Kohl's.
Yes.
That's the story.
Tell me what happened in the Kohl's bathroom, please.
Once I was at a Kohl's with my mom, and I vividly remember this experience because it was the first time I was going to the bathroom by myself. I was like a big boy, ready to go, all that. So my mom was giving me a pep talk outside the bathroom, and she said my name a bunch. Okay, this is an important part of the story. I go into the bathroom. I'm using the urinal because I'm a cool kid, right? And there's one other person in the bathroom, and he begins whispering my name. So when he first said it, I thought like I was hallucinating. It was my first time. I was scared. But then he kept saying my name, and every time he said it, he increased his tone. He increased the frequency of which he was saying my name. And I sprinted out of the bathroom. Isn't that awful? So I still to the... This is TMI. I still to this day have a little bit of stage fright in the bathroom.
I'm sorry. What the fuck is that?
I don't know, man. It was awful. And then I ran to my mom, like tears running down my face. She tried to get the people. The guy had left the bathroom at that point. It was a whole
thing. God.
Anyways.
That's scary. That's my story. That is the creepiest thing I've ever heard.
Sponsor us, Kohl's.
I hope you let me leave that in.
Oh, please. Go for it. Okay. So today I will be covering the most densely populated city on Earth that has ever existed ever. And this is according to multiple sources, and I sure hope they aren't lying. I'm so sorry. I mispronounced it earlier. It's Kowloon.
Interesting.
So The cow, it's spelled K-O-W-L-O-O-N, Kowloon. Okay, so O-O-L? When I, O-O-N, K-O-W.
Do you know what's weird? I don't know what this is, but like when people list off letters and numbers quickly in a sequence, my brain just completely stops. Like, when I was like working at, in a position where I had to like take people's like address and phone number information.
That is exactly what I was going to mention.
Especially, okay, in some populations, they use the phonetic alphabet and they just like spit at you like, Bravo, Romeo.
Alpha, Zulu. And I'm like, brother, please.
November. And I'm like, okay. I can't. I was like, I'm going to need you to do that girl. So much slower.
Like, I do not speak this language, please and thank you.
I used to have, like, a chart at my desk so that I could, like, but still, they do it so fast and it's hard. And even, I mean, even without the phonetic alphabet, if people are just, like, spelling something super fast, my brain does not compute.
My big issue is zip codes. Whenever someone tells me their zip code, I always have to repeat it back to them in 50% chance that I fucked it up.
I personally, when I'm giving my address or telephone number to someone, like, doctor's office or whatever, I personally try to go at the pace I would prefer so that they can calmly and in a relaxed state write down my information.
I love it. And you know what? That's your charitable work.
Thank you. It is my gift to the world.
And that's it. You will not get anything else.
I do what I can, you know?
And you know what? I think that's called a giver.
I think so.
Okay. So in looking up the Kowloon Walled City, which moving forward, I'm going to be calling it the KWC. Thank you very much. Okay. And looking it up, the KWC. KWC.
No, but truly, like, my brain did stop for a second.
I saw the pause.
That one was easier because it was short, but I had to, like,
at three. Once you go four, game over.
I was trying, since it was an acronym, I was trying to assign it to the words you had said just previously.
Gotcha.
God.
Okay, so when looking this up, I found one source that seemed rather reliable that stated that the history of the KWC dates back from the Sung Dynasty around 1300, but I'm pretty sure that's incorrect.
Okay.
Because everything else that I read later on suggested that it came from, not suggested, claimed that it came from the 1800s. So we're just going to flash forward a couple of years to the 1800s. Most sources note that the origin of the KWC occurred around the 1840s, following the First Opium War. So, I'm going to start just a little general overview. I'm going to give you a history lesson, and I'm so sorry. History was my least favorite subject in school, but I think this stuff is actually really quite fascinating.
I'm here and for it.
Then I'm going to go into the specifics of the city and what life was like, and bada bing, bada boom.
Beautiful.
Okay, so around the 1840s, China had signed a treaty with Great Britain to prevent the East India Company from importing narcotics into China. Also, the East India Company sounded vaguely familiar to me. I'm sure it was talked about in history. So I looked it up, actually. Hey now, it's almost a deep dive podcast. And basically, the East India Company was an English company, would trick you, English company formed for the exploitation of trade with East and Southeast Asia in India, and later disbanded in the late 1800s, as the British did in the past, exploit, you know?
Gotta love it.
Oh, and this is from British Wikipedia. Exactly, right?
British Wikipedia!
British Wikipedia, we love you! Okay, so in this treaty that China and Great Britain had signed, China had ceded a near deserted mountainous island to the British. And this island is also known as present day Hong Kong. I didn't know anything about Hong Kong, so that's cool.
Interesting. I didn't know Hong Kong was an island.
I didn't either. Also, side note, Hong Kong was given back to the People's Republic of China in July of 1997.
That's fake.
Isn't that wild? So British, the British people owned Hong Kong until 1997.
That's crazy.
Right? Like, it's amazing how so many of these revelations in society have happened so short ago.
Although, do you know what I heard someone say the other day? Is that, like, the 90s was 30 years ago.
Miss me with that right now. You get out. You get out. Like, those things just, that age you. Oof.
I know, because like when I think of the 90s, I think of it as like maybe
it was just yesterday.
A decade running.
Yeah. Like, maybe a decade and a half. I don't know.
Yes. Decade and a half. Like, no, it's like 30 years. Yikes.
Awful.
Yeah.
Okay. So going back, why am I talking about Hong Kong? That's a great question. You did not ask. Hong Kong happens to be just opposite of a peninsula known as the Kowloon Peninsula. So in 1847, go ahead.
Is it still named that today?
I believe so.
Okay.
We're going to say yes and believe it to be true. Fantastic.
Cool. Amazing.
Thank you. So, in 1847, the assistant magistrate of the Sun On County, also, I'm so sorry if I mispronounce anything. I really did try to look things up, but whatever.
We do our best.
Thank you. So, the assistant magistrate of the Sun On County successfully petitioned to build a fort at the very tip of the Kowloon Peninsula to establish military presence near the new British colony, aka Hong Kong. Did not look into the specifics of the treaty. And by did not look into the specifics of the treaty, I mean I did not look into it at all. But amazing. I think it's a safe assumption to make that the Chinese were forced by Great Britain to hand Hong Kong over in this whole opium war fiasco.
I see.
Side note, I really love this power play by the Chinese people. They said, if you're going to take our land, we're going to build a military colony directly across from you where we're going to look at you every single day.
Kudos. Love that for them.
Kudos. So, this military colony, also known as the KWC, acted initially as a barracks for around 150 soldiers, and this colony was surrounded by a wall that was 700 feet long and 400 feet wide. However, in 1860, there was a second opium war where the British and French forces overpowered the Chinese forces, resulting in a new treaty that granted the whole of the Kowloon Peninsula to the British. Except for one small piece, the KWC.
I see.
So, I tried looking into why the KWC was not given over. Some sources suggested that it was symbolic to the Chinese. Other sources suggested that because it was a military garrison, which also, that's a word they use, and I have no idea what a garrison is, nor will I look it up, damn it.
We'll just go with it.
But because it was a military garrison, it may have caused even more war and fighting, and so this was a way just to separate. Do your own thing.
Try to maintain some peace.
Exactly. Perhaps. But that doesn't stop a colonizer. So, over the next 30 years, the British attempted to gain control of the KWC. At one point, the British did, quote-unquote, take control of the KWC. But when they did so, the Chinese never renounced their claim of it. So, they basically, the British came in, they kicked everyone out, and they actually had missionaries and farmers move into this area. However, because of the lack of administrative control, the city eventually became a slum. And this situation of this area being not populated, populated, then not populated, remained unresolved until World War II, when the Japanese forces tore down the walls of the city to build a new runway for an airport.
Interesting.
So,
okay.
Right. I know. I'm really taking you through a history lesson. I apologize.
It's okay. I am. You're really testing my attention.
I know. I know. Right. I'm no, so sorry. But
I'm here for it. You're making it interesting. So, thank
okay.
You.
Fantastic. Good. Thank you.
Honest to God, my problem with history is that once it gets into years,
dates,
names of wars, treaties, yes. Countries, cities, like
game of
names
literally of anything people, about history, actually.
Like,
not that you mentioned when it.
When there's a lot of like
history.
But I am, you are making it possible for me to follow.
Thank you so much.
You're so good at this.
Okay, so in the aftermath of World War II, the city was left in shambles. However, many refugees flooded into the KWC seeking refuge. Quick side note, One of the articles I am using, which one? I don't know. It's one of them. You can figure it out. stated something along the lines of, despite the horrid conditions present in the KWC, many people gravitated towards it, possibly because of feng shui.
Interesting.
Or, in my mind, maybe it's because they were displaced due to a world war. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know. I wonder.
Yeah, possibly, mayhaps, it's because of war. But the article did go on to state that many properties of the city were built with feng shui in mind. I don't know much about it.
Honestly, maybe I'll cover that sometime because...
I think it's a fascinating topic.
Yeah, I don't know much about it either. But it's like, I would love it to learn more. Interesting to me.
Right?
We'll see. I'll go on my list. But
in terms of the city was facing south and overlooking water with mountains to the north. So I think that is in line with feng shui properties.
Interesting. All right.
By 1947, more than 2,000 individuals resided within the city. And what I found really fascinating and also heartbreaking is that their huts were arranged in the exact footprint of the original city. Because keep in mind, the KWC is still technically owned by China, but any land outside of the borders of that city was under British control. And so if they were to have stepped foot outside or lived outside, then they can be done with whatever the British want to do with them.
Right.
So because they were scared to leave the walls, they made sure to like follow the exact footprint, make sure they weren't building anything outside of the lines. Which is amazing, but also I can't imagine living in a scenario where like everything you do is scrutinized and looked. It's just wild to me.
We are blessed to live.
Truly, very much so. That is for certain.
Not that we are. Just
go. I know where you're going with this.
I just want to make it clear that like I'm not like pro-nationalism. Like United States has some problems.
100%. And by some, a lot.
A lot.
Thank you for the clarification. So, in the beginning of 1948, Hong Kong officials, keep in mind, again, under British rule, were appalled by the conditions in the KWC, so they attempted to clear the refugees, which worked, however, only for a week, when individuals then promptly returned and began rebuilding the homes that they had knocked down.
Wow.
After recognizing this, Hong Kong police attempted to intervene, but the residents of KWC basically became a movement or a cause where students in Shanghai were protesting for the rights of the KWC people, and the Chinese government officials encouraged the refugees to continue fighting against their oppressors, which there may be a little bit more of a sinister reason why the Chinese government officials did so, which we'll talk about later. And then also government authorities began distributing food and medical aid with messages of advocating for militant action. So they were really like, stick it to the man.
Yeah. It's crazy that, like, did we learn about this in history?
No. KWC, I don't think we ever learned about. Granted, I don't remember anything I learned about in history. If you couldn't tell.
We are not the best people to ask.
Not at all. Okay. After beginning to distribute food and medical aid with the messages of stick it to the man, the Chinese government argued that they still had jurisdiction over the city because, again, they never forfeited or gave it away in a treaty or anything of the sort over both the city and its people. And after many, many, many moons of battling back and forth, the eviction program against the KWC finally came to a halt.
Yay!
Amazing. So this is where now we can begin getting into the specifics regarding life in the KWC, which I personally find the most fascinating. Again, in my notes, I say I apologize for that history lesson.
I am so excited to hear about the culture.
Yes. As I mentioned at the beginning, this city was the most densely populated city that has ever been known to
like
man.
Like per square foot.
Correct. And I have some comparisons later on.
Okay.
So the city is like no other that has ever existed. Despite the Chinese claiming jurisdiction over the KWC, there was no day-to-day administration or regulation of the city. There were no taxes. There were no health or planning systems. There was no police, no regulation of business. And this was a city with completely no oversight. Wow. Importantly, there were also, because there was no government oversight, there were no building codes which they had to adhere to, which yes. is how the city became the most densely populated city ever. Because instead of having to abide by structural engineering and blah, 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 they just kept on building up, which blows my mind. Also, both you and our listeners, highly recommend you looking up a picture of the city if you want to do that now or later, whatever.
I will do it now.
It is.
It was
K O W L O O N.
Thank you.
Of course.
Okay, let me look. Whoa.
Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
Like.
Yeah, it's just like a wall of like apartment buildings, it looks like.
Literally, like, literally, that is exactly
wild.
What it is.
Wild.
So while you're looking at it, at its peak, the city had about 50,000 inhabitants on 7 acres of land. So for comparison, a football field is 1.32 acres. So 50,000 people were living on 5.3 football fields of land.
That's crazy.
That's a lot of people on very little land.
That is
scientifically. That is my scientific observation.
That is a lot.
A lot. You're welcome. And that's it. That's all we can provide you.
Wow.
So getting into some of the specifics of the city. Due to the lawless nature of this area, it became a hot spot for some criminal activities.
Understand.
There were 5 triad gangs. I don't really know what the triad means in there, but there were 5 gangs. The names were listed. I didn't feel like it was important to include them. Maybe it was. I don't know.
They were gangs.
They were gangs.
That's all we need to know.
Ironically, the KWC, which was initially intended to police and traffic opium in those opium wars, now became a hotspot for the creation and distribution of not only opium, but also heroin.
Damn.
In regards to the town specifics, there were about 350 buildings, almost all between 10 and 14 stories tall. I think, and I don't know if I included it in my notes, but one of the articles stated that because they just continuously built everything on top of one another, all of the buildings basically just merged into one. And it looked like the buildings were hugging each other or kissing each other because of how close they were to one another.
Damn.
There were hundreds of alleyways, most being just a few feet wide. Thousands of metal and plastic pipes, most of them leaking and corroded. They completely lined the walls in all areas. People reported constant dripping on top of them. Some people, wherever they went in the KWC, would always have an umbrella with them so that they don't have like leaking water or drainage or sewage or electricity things constantly touching them. There were only 2 elevators in the entire city. So most individuals, if they wanted to reach a higher area, would physically have to climb up. And also, I found it really interesting that the KWC had postmen delivering mail. So they would... whatever you wanted mail, you would nail a mailbox to a wall somewhere near where you lived, and they would begin delivering mail. But the postmen, because they had to go up floors, would start climbing up floors physically to begin disseminating the mail that they had found.
So when you're saying climbing, like, did they not have stairs? Like, are they climbing, like, ladders?
Some had stairs, some didn't. Some would have to go on rooftops and jump down because everything was just, like, one... big conglomerate,
just
basically.
Just like chaos.
Literally, yeah.
Wow.
To give you a little feel of the town, I'm going to read an excerpt from an article I found. Which one it is, I don't know. I'm so sorry, but you can figure it out. So, hundreds of factories produced everything from fish balls to golf balls. Entire corridors were coated with the fine flour dust used for making noodles. Acrid chemical smells filled the streets that lay alongside metal and plastic manufacturers. Unlicensed doctors and dentists clustered together, electric signs hanging over their premises to advertise their services, and even many patients came from outside the city, happy to pay bargain fees in return for asking no questions.
Oh my god. This is like a criminal's dream.
Right? That's what I'm saying.
I don't know, because you know how, at least in America, like, if you show up to a hospital with a gunshot wound, the police are, I'm pretty sure that it's required to be investigated.
Oh, I didn't know that. Gotcha. I sure hope so.
I could be making that up, and it's possible I got that information from, like, SVU, Law and Order.
And you know what? That is fact.
I truly don't know if I'm accurate on that, but still, the idea is probably somewhat similar.
100%.
But... I imagine that being able to, like, do your gang activity and go to a shady doctor No questions.
Don't mind if I do.
You don't ask questions. They don't ask questions.
Bada bing, bada boom. And are they trained? Maybe. Probably not.
I mean, honestly, that is a very scary situation. I want to go to a doctor who I know is
licensed. Yeah, who, like, I don't know, received some training, knows what they're doing.
Went to medical school.
I guess. Someone's, like, plucking your tooth out, and it's like, hey, that's the wrong tooth. It was on the opposite side of my mouth. Oh, I'm like, oh, well, no questions. I do want to preface and say that while I have been talking somewhat negatively about this town, and I will continue to do so for a little bit, I am going to get into the positives later on because I think there's a lot of beauty in this type of community that they've created.
Of course. And the whole, you know, like...
Stick it to them.
Stick it to the man. Like,
oh my God,
the resilience, I think that's phenomenal. Too. Like, they got kicked out and they're like, no.
Yes. That word just kept on coming into my mind time and time again as I was going through this.
Yeah.
So, moving on back to crime.
People are stronger than us.
100%. And, no, yeah, stronger than us. Yeah, stronger than me for sure. Yeah. As we talked about in the last episode, I'm done for. If you catch me in the middle of Antarctica, done for.
I think your exact quote was, I get a paper cut and it's game over.
That sounds like me. Yeah.
But yes, we are not the risk takers. I am not one who would be resilient enough, I don't think, to last there. I'd be like,
one drop of water.
Yeah. I'm happy I don't have to test my resilience.
Yes.
In that Please, way.
Knock on wood.
Yeah, seriously. Okay, anyway, I'm so sorry. Go on.
Okay. Of course, as one would expect in an area with no regulation, illegal acts such as gambling, prostitution, and drug usage ran rampant throughout the city. At the Kwong Ming Street, which was a very popular street in the KWC, I believe, fingers crossed, there were wooden stalls that sold cheap drugs. And right above these stalls where the drugs were produced, individuals would crouch down to try and inhale the heroin smoke that was created in the process of making heroin. Wow. One source I found stated that many of the city's rats were also addicted to heroin due to how prevalent the heroin smoke was throughout the city.
Wow.
Isn't that wild? And they would catch them like convulsing in the corner. I forget what word they used, but something of the sort. Like, that's wild.
Oh my gosh.
And locals called the KWC Hak Nam, again, I'm so sorry if I mispronounced that, also known as the City of Darkness, because there were basically no windows, there was no light. Once you were in the center of it, you didn't know which way it was up, right, left, down, whatever it may be.
That is the most emo name I've ever heard.
Right? That's what I'm saying. The City of Darkness. Yeah, you have to say it in deep voice. So, this is kind of going what I was talking about before. Taking a step back, it is important to note that many of these sources I have used have been from Western outlets, and Western outlets have a tendency to add a lot of doom and gloom to scenarios, which a lot of these things are very true. However, one article I found was the author's father had grown up near the KWC and had visited it many times, and so he gave his view, perspective, experiences. Okay. And pointed out that while there were many negatives, such as the gangs, the drug uses, hazards to people everywhere, etc., the KWC was much more complex than just these negatives. This individual claimed that the triad gangs had organized volunteer fire brigades, rubbish disposal crews, they resolved civil conflicts, which I don't know how a gang would resolve a civil conflict without bias, but I'm going to go with that, etc.
But it sounds almost like a Lord of the Flies situation, like... People were left ungoverned, and so humans need some sort of structure and order.
Absolutely, right?
That's actually really beautiful. Like, you know how...
I think so.
You know how there are, like, motorcycle gangs in the U.S. who are, like, super, like, protective of children? Like, they're,
yes,
pedophiles. Like, we are going to protect these kids. And it's, like, amazing. It can happen. I love that.
Right?
I'm going to imagine them like that over there.
Yes, as you should. I think building community is one of the most beautiful things ever. And they seem to have really built a community, which fantastic. So the gangs, they had organized the fire brigades, disposal crew, resolved conflicts, etc. Despite not having the best conditions, the KWC was home to thousands of people. And there are many reports of individuals after the city was taken down, which I'll get to in a bit, being dissatisfied with their eviction and actually wanting to remain in the city because that was their home.
Yeah.
And wow. Like you were talking about earlier, I think it is incredibly important to highlight the resiliency and the adaptability KWC residents had. Despite facing tight restrictions and not being able to go outside their land or build outside their land, restrictions in regards to their resources, in regards to the architecture of the city, they always met the demands of the people that resided there and worked together to create a community, beautiful. Which I find to be phenomenal and incredible.
So beautiful.
Right?
And let's not forget that, like, this is a city made up of refugees.
100%, right? Like, they're already displaced going through one of the most difficult things anyone could experience in their entire... And they managed to do...
I have goosebumps.
Right? Isn't it such a phenomenal...
It's so beautiful. Yeah.
And now I'm going to bring them back down and crush your hopes and dreams.
Okay. So ready for it.
Well, yeah, the real world. I did forget to mention one thing earlier because I didn't want to keep on spewing dates and treaties with you. Not forget, I intentionally left this out. However, in the 1800s, the late 1800s, the Chinese government signed another treaty with Great Britain. So they initially signed a treaty with Great Britain to give them Hong Kong, and then they signed another treaty after the Second Opium War to give over Kowloon Peninsula. Uh-huh. And then in this later treaty, they basically gave over a lot more. They gave over Hong Kong, Kowloon, and other territories to Britain, except for the KWC. This comes into play because, unfortunately, for many residents of the KWC, in 1987, the Hong Kong Housing Department began surveying every resident in the KWC with plans to demolish the city. So, like I'd mentioned earlier, there was a lot of back and forth that occurred between Hong Kong and the KWC, trying to break it down, run people out, and they just continued to be resilient. But in part, that was because they had support from Chinese government officials, from the students in Shanghai, and things of that nature. However, this treaty that they signed at the late 1800s was a 99-year treaty. And so in 1987, they were coming up on that end of their 99 years where they would get back all their land. So Chinese government officials no longer supported the KWC. And when individuals from the Hong Kong Housing Department began surveying everyone and people were all up in arms, the Chinese government officials were nowhere to be found.
Wait a second. Okay, hold on.
Go.
I need to...
Please.
Okay, so the 99-year treaty, I thought that Britain ended up with everything but the KWC. Was the treaty correct. 99 years for KWC?
No, the treaties was they were going to give over Hong Kong and all these other areas for 99 years.
But then why did China abandon KWC? Because, like, wouldn't they get it back if the treaty was up in 99 years?
Great question. So my speculation is that Chinese government officials never wanted KWC to begin with. And some of the sources... Oh, go ahead.
Can I clarify my question?
Please.
Did China get back their land?
Correct. They did.
So who was surveying them? China or Britain?
So when I say Hong Kong Housing Department, keep in mind that at this time, they're still owned by British people.
British. But they're about to lose that land, right?
Correct. So I don't really know why they did this. I don't really know all the specifics. That's what I'm saying, right? Oops. And also, I don't know if in the treaty it specified that the People's Republic of China or whatever it was at the time got back this land, but it's just because the treaty ended, then if the British people didn't give back the land of the Chinese people, then they would start a whole fight or anything of the sort.
Okay. So China was going to get it back. The British were surveying the KWC. The 99-year treaty was coming up to be expired, and the Chinese government was not interested in protecting the KWC. And then you were about to tell me your theories on why.
Also, one thing to note, while British land did own Hong Kong, I don't know if it was them specifically forcing them to do this. And by them, I mean people in Hong Kong that resided in Hong Kong. Or if Hong Kong themselves were like, this is an eyesore, we don't want to be associated. So, like, they just did it, and it wasn't necessarily influenced by...
It wasn't necessarily, like, Great Britain saying to
like,
do
their
this,
order,
like-
yeah. Just nearby area.
Okay, go on.
Okay, so, Hong Kong Housing Department began surveying. I'm just going to read what I wrote. While prior attempts at demolishing the city had failed due to the support provided by the Chinese government, the KWC no longer had Chinese support as they were approaching the end of their 99-year treaty, where they would soon reclaim Hong Kong, Kowloon, etc. Many articles reported that the Chinese government continued to protect the KWC throughout the years leading up to this, so that the KWC could act as sort of a political pawn to remind the British and really the entire world of their rightful claim to this land.
And so
that might be one of the main reasons why they continue to support them. But then at the end, when they were going to get the land back, they're like, well, we would prefer you not be there. So good luck.
That sucks.
But in slightly positive note, the compensation package for residents and business owners totaled $2.76 billion. So on average, residents received around $380,000 for their homes, which
at least
is a substantial amount of money. Granted, is that you can't put a price on someone's home, and if they didn't want to leave, then obviously they have a right to not leave. But then governments do what governments do.
It's better than nothing.
Yeah, right?
It's better than just getting displaced and saying,
fuck. And I really hope because that's one of the articles I found. Again, which one? I don't know. They said that. So I really hope that's the actual amount that they received, because they deserve that and then some.
Yes, they do.
This brings us to the end of the story. After they surveyed residents, there was some small portion that refused to leave, but then finally were kicked out. And this brings us to the end of the story, where on March 23rd, 1993, a wrecking ball smashed into the side of the city and began the demolition of the city. But also, this initial wrecking ball smashing into the side of the city, it was one time they hit it, and then they actually began demolition like 2 weeks after. It was just like a symbolic.
Okay, that's silly.
And then on December 22nd, 1995, the land that once was the KWC became the Kowloon Walled City Park. So they made a park out of that land. And that's all I got. KWC.
Wow. Damn. I don't even know what to say. That's wild.
You got me there.
A lawless land.
I think it would have been absolutely fascinating, though, to just visit and see that environment and see how different factors within the KWC interacted with other different factors. Like, I just think it is so absolutely fascinating.
It's just kind of crazy to think about.
Right?
Like, that existed.
I know that there are some communities or groups of people or whatever they are technically called by, like, out in the middle of, like, Death Valley or something of the sort. Like, out in the middle of the desert, where they just, like, built their own little area. And so they don't have, like, direct oversight because there's no one that's living near them. But something of this magnitude, where there are tens of thousands of people in such a confined space... mind-boggling.
And the fact that there are people there, like, actually, like,
right? These, like, wild. And I remember, in regards to the architecture, there were no professional structural engineers, or many articles suggested that it was very rushed in the construction of the entire area. But it stayed up. It stayed up that entire time. Pretty incredible, if you ask me.
It lasted longer than the molasses tank.
That is so true.
That shit lasted for 4
years.
Pure
negligence right there, baby.
What is Death Valley?
I think Death Valley is like one of the hottest places in the United States. It's, I think, a valley. I say that with like 30% certainty.
Here, I'll Google Thank it for so our much. Curiosity.
I think it's California. Yeah, so it's just on the California side of the California-Nevada border.
Oh, well, things to know. How long could you survive in Death Valley?
Me? 2 seconds.
And no, not you specifically. In this desert, you can only live 14 hours without water.
Yeah, I think it gets like the hottest. No way. Death Valley holds the record for the highest air temperature on the planet, where it reached 134.1 degrees Fahrenheit. Right?
Bro, I hate the desert.
Would you rather be... One of my family members asked this, and this isn't related to deserts, but we can adapt it. Would you rather be in 100% humidity or minus 10 wind chill? Like, are you a moist girl or a cold girl?
I'm a moist girl.
I'm so sorry those words came out of my mouth.
Oh my god. No, I... Okay. I have really only been out west once in my adult life. Like, I think I was in California once as a baby or a toddler, and I don't remember that.
Doesn't count.
Exactly. a couple years ago, I went to Nevada. I learned, because people have always said, at least over here, like, I know that you grew up in Nevada, and so your experience is probably totally different. Maybe not, I don't know. But here on the East Coast, like, if you're complaining about the heat in the summer,
yeah.
My entire life people have been like, oh, have you ever experienced dry heat? It's the best because you don't get all sweaty. And I was expecting to, like, go to the West and experience this magical situation where the heat is, like, hot but not hot. And let me fucking tell you,
scorching.
There is nothing worse than I hate dry heat. I actually, it turns out, I fucking love the humidity, actually.
Give it to me. I want more, actually. 110% humidity.
So I didn't really answer the wind chill question because I don't really know how to answer that one.
You're a moist girl. Yeah.
I'm a moist girl for sure. What about you?
Yeah. I've not experienced either, really.
Well, comparing the dry heat to humidity.
I haven't experienced humidity. I mean, I've been in California. California has like 20 or 30% humidity. And I've been to the East Coast, but I've only been to the East Coast during the winter.
Oh, and it's dry out here in the
yeah.
winter. Okay. We should do a closeout. Like, we should say goodbye for the end of the episode.
Goodbye.
For listening, and you can follow us on Instagram at Medium Dives Pod. If you like the show, send it to your friends. Thanks. Bye.